Hello, welcome to the Find Your Calm podcast. I'm Noelle C. Guevara, and through my work as a pastor, an educator, and a writer, I have helped many people find their calm as they navigate faith and family and being a person in this chaotic life. Here's the truth. I don't know how to avoid chaos or how to prevent the anxiety that chaos inevitably causes, but I have had more than a little practice in finding my calm when life beckons anxiety instead. If you're looking for space to take a deep breath, steady yourself, and discern what you need to move forward, you're right where you belong. Listen in for a few simple tips to find your calm and take your next faithful steps forward. Today, we're going to begin an honest conversation about mental health, and more specifically, what it looks like to walk through a mental health crisis. My daughter will be joining me for this conversation because we've walked a long, hard road through this valley of shadows together. There is no greater chaos that I've had to hold the line through than this one, and it's just far enough in the rearview mirror for objects to still be closer than they appear. But we are so grateful to sit side by side on the other side of the waves that fought to pull us under. When Isabel first came to me and said she wanted to be a guest on my podcast, this was her idea. I didn't talk her into it. And she's going to join me for a conversation later in this episode. But I knew the story that she would tell would be important, but also difficult. I share a lot of faithful steps forward in the midst of different brands of chaos, some of which are the everyday sort, like holidays, and some of which are more industrial strength sort, like a marriage crisis. Woven through those episodes I've alluded to or talked a little bit about navigating the struggles we faced with mental health, season one was really birthed out of my own work to remain calm amidst a crisis brewing on the home front. In season two, I dipped my toes into sharing a little bit about that crisis. I talked about navigating anxiety in your family and when your child carries a label, and also supporting a loved one through recovery. Today, we're going to dig a little deeper into mental health matters. I'm going to give a more specific content warning at the beginning of each episode, just to give you space to reach for some tools to stay present if that's helpful, or to give you the opportunity to skip the episode entirely if it's likely to trigger you. In today's episode, I'll reference self-harm and suicidal ideation without getting into any details or using any graphic language. Before we launch into today's conversation, let me share why it matters to you. I think we've all heard or read enough to know that there is a current and worsening mental health crisis. Some quick stats from the National Alliance on Mental Illness that might bring that reality closer to home. 1 in 5 U.S. adults experience mental illness every year. 1 in 20 U.S. adults experience serious mental illness each year. 1 in 6 U.S. youth, so ages 6 to 17, experience a mental health disorder each year. 50% of all lifetime mental illness begins by the age of 14, and 75% begins by the age of 24. Now, these are the known and diagnosed cases, 1 in 5 adults, 1 in 6 children. Those numbers translate to a reality that someone in your immediate circle of family or friends is coping or will cope with a diagnosed mental illness. That person might even be you. The one thing I know for certain about mental illness is that it is far more debilitating when the person feels alone in it all. So we're going to move forward with the intention of learning to do this together. If you are someone coping with a mental illness, struggling with your mental health, or even experiencing a mental health crisis, I hope our story will encourage you to reach out. If someone you love is coping with mental illness or a crisis, I hope our story will encourage you to lean in. For everyone, I hope it offers a few next faithful steps forward in finding your calm as together we face the reality of the current mental health crisis. So here's how the story begins for me. Flashback to August of 2021. The moment my daughter's therapist called me back into her office and closed the door. I knew deep down that my life was about to come to one of those before and after splits, where the wave that was cresting would change me forever. The therapist told me in the calmest and kindest way possible that Isabel's struggle with depression was serious. I remember hearing words like self-harm and suicidal ideations and knowing exactly what those words meant and also not knowing at all how they could be true. I struggled to be present, to stay connected to myself and the moment. It was overwhelming. It was terrifying. It was heart-crushing. I knew my daughter needed some things from me in that moment, to hear that I believed her, that I loved her unconditionally, and that those two things were not just true in the moment, but a promise for whatever was ahead. I wanted a quick fix, or even better, to fix it all myself. But we would spend the next 2 years in the liminal space between before and after, riding the wave of a mental health crisis. Eventually, that crisis received clearer names in the form of diagnoses, and we'll get into that a little bit more later. But my perspective is just that. It's just mine, one-sided and likely familiar if you are a regular listener of the podcast. Today, I'm so grateful to be able to invite Isabel into this conversation so we can share from both perspectives what it was like, what it is still like to navigate mental health matters. Isabel, welcome to the podcast. I'm excited, a little nervous about this conversation, but I'm so proud of you for not just being willing to, but offering to speak on this topic.
Yeah, I'm excited and nervous too.
Yeah, fair. Microphone in your face is a whole thing. So we're going to jump right in to your perspective, your side of the story. So Isabel, if you could share where this story begins for you. I shared kind of where it began for me, but where did it really begin? Where did it start for you?
I think it really started in the summer of 2021. I first noticed it in June. I'd probably say more July. I was constantly busying myself, trying to distract myself from like any sort of feeling. So I was 16 at the time, and a 16-year-old probably shouldn't be working 8 hours a day every day, but I was because I did not want to think anymore. And that's when I really noticed like the start and the struggle.
Yeah, and you were like picking up extra shifts. Yes. Like it wasn't just like, oh, you had a full-time job that was predictable. It was like anytime. You could work more, you worked more. Yes. So maybe some like avoidance that we didn't really notice.
100%.
So summer of 2021, you're working a lot. You're kind of trying to avoid like what? Did you have a sense of why you were trying to be so busy?
No, I didn't think I really had a sense of exactly what I was trying to avoid. The things I was feeling, like, sad or, like, kind of reserved, like, I just hadn't felt that before. Mm. I knew something was wrong, and I didn't really want to talk to anybody about it, and I didn't want to confront it with myself. Mm. And so I'm an avoider. So I just took every shift I could, hung out with friends whenever I could, and just kind of escaped from my reality in that way.
Yeah, that makes sense. So today our conversation is going to turn to the things that we didn't know. And I almost called this episode Mistakes Were Made, but decided to take a little pivot towards some self-compassion and rename those mistakes as growth. So there were things that we didn't know yet back in the summer of 2021. Way back at the beginning, we didn't know what triggered the crisis. We didn't realize or recognize some early warning signs that were foreshadowing a coming crash. We didn't know how to treat it. We didn't know which responses and treatments would be unhelpful or ineffective, but we would grow to know those things with lots and lots and lots of practice and education, treatment, support, all the things. We're going to talk more about that, some of that action plan stuff in the next episode. But back to the beginning and what we didn't know then that we know now. Your diagnosis in what seemed to me like an overnight crash was a shock. It's not like I was completely oblivious. So I knew that you generally struggled with anxiety. Like we knew this. And you had since you were little. Your dad and I, we were in conversations with you about how you felt overwhelmed by the upcoming school year. I remember like a few really pointed conversations we had about that. But we were still kind of in the midst of a pandemic. So honestly, like the symptoms that you presented with were really easy to explain as normal, all things considered. We had no idea how deeply you were struggling. And I see that like also knowing we're very highly trained and informed parents. For sure. And you were a teenager. You are now an adult who was pretty open and close with us. Yeah. So it wasn't like, you know, we were not in communication. Mm-hmm. Like I said, you weren't hiding in your room. You weren't sleeping all the time. You weren't engaging in at-risk behaviors. Mm-hmm. You were working a summer job you seemed to enjoy. You were going to youth group. You were doting on your little siblings. So it honestly seemed to me like you crashed overnight.
Yeah.
But there were things below the surface that we just didn't know. So can you talk a little bit more about that? What were some of those early warning signs? I know you talked about like working more, but maybe try and articulate some of the things that you were feeling now mm-hmm. that you can look back. Like yeah. at the time you didn't know, but what were some things you were feeling? Or what were some behaviors or symptoms that were present, but that we just missed or didn't see?
Yeah, for sure. So I think one of the other symptoms besides like avoiding was like self-isolating. So if I wasn't working, if I wasn't out, I was in my room, which might not have like been super noticeable to you guys, because at 11 o'clock at night, I would obviously be in my room. But it was like what was happening during that time. Like it was a lot of ruminating, a lot of like negative coping mechanisms, like self-harm and stuff like that. Like it started like small, like just like small things, and then it just kind of grew bigger. And then I also, like, the avoiding was definitely a big thing. And then I think like when we got to our vacation, which is where like everything kind of blew up, mm-hmm. I was just like confronted with the fact that I do have to go to school, I do mm-hmm. have to go back, and freaked out. And mm-hmm. so that was another thing, is like overreacting, even though like looking back it probably wasn't a super big overreaction. Mm-hmm. But after it had been bottled up for so long, like, I freaked out. And so, like, a warning sign is, like, bottling it up and the avoiding and stuff.
Yeah. So what I hear from you is that it was really kind of a longer pattern or a longer journey of, like, having some feelings, trying to out-hustle, out-run, avoid them when you were alone, which was kind of, like, normal. Like, we go mm-hmm. to bed in our own rooms or whatever. That's when you are really ruminating or like mm-hmm. thinking a lot about some of the thoughts and feelings that were overwhelming, turning inward instead of asking for help. And then the things that you were avoiding as they started to catch up, all of a sudden it was like big reaction instead.
And it wasn't manageable. Like, I feel like for me, it wasn't like concerning to me. Like I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so depressed. I like don't want to be here anymore. It wasn't like that. It was more like just stressing, like, oh my gosh, I have to go to school, or tomorrow I have to go to work, and thinking. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to talk to anybody about it. So I just turned to other things.
Sure. Which, yeah, was a whole process and journey. And there were some things, like, we won't get into that now, but there were some things specifically tied to school that were triggers that mm-hmm. you hadn't yet uncovered.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was kind of at play underneath the surface that we didn't even know and couldn't have known.
Like, yeah.
Even you yourself didn't really fully get that picture. So
always hard when your mind is your own enemy.
Yeah. That's a great point. But yeah, I think something I really grabbed onto there is just that you're stressed, you're ruminating, but you're not verbalizing it to other people or to people that could maybe mm-hmm. help, just working through it on your own. Yeah. We all do that. We can get stuck in our own heads with our problems for sure. Mm-hmm. So I've definitely learned that it's not productive, you know, as we're talking about reflecting on the past, it's not productive to go back and berate myself or you to berate yourself or even run like a diagnostic assessment on what we should have done differently. But I have considered some learnings and I carry forward different approaches to parenting all of my kids. Moving forward, you have younger siblings, right? So it's less about what I wish I'd done differently 3 years ago because I just can't go there. And it's more about what I'm doing differently now. So along with you, I have another adult child or a child transitioning. She'll be 18, about to head off to college. But I also still have two young kids at home. So both of them have their own struggles with mental health as well. So for those of you listening, I'm going to share a few faithful steps that I'm carrying forward because of what this experience has shown me. And then Isabel, I'm going to invite you to do the same. So first, I'm leaning heavily into early interventions and supports because we are done white knuckling our way through our struggles. Anxiety, depression, ADHD, whatever, where I used to ask the question, can we manage this with tools versus treatment? I now ask, what treatment will help make it easier to access the tools we need to manage this? And it's a slight flip, right? Like focusing on tools and treatment is a little hazy, but the flip has been a night and day difference in the life of someone who's in the middle of a battle. So I still struggle a lot with guilt when I have to talk to my child's doctor about adding or increasing a medication, when I see some of that white knuckling. But I'm constantly reminding myself that just because I have training and expertise or intuition or whatever, and I can support my kids through a struggle, it doesn't mean that that's the best solution for any of us. You are not a hero for battling depression through self-help books or prayer or sheer will. You are not a better mom for minimizing or even just accommodating your child's anxiety so they can manage without medication. Again, I'm not an expert, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a doctor, I'm not telling you what treatment is right for you, but we're not heroes for avoiding supports. So last week, my son Zion, he twisted his ankle and I thought he was fine. He didn't seem terribly bothered, so I sent him to school, and then I got the call of shame from the school nurse. Oh my gosh, parents get the calls of shame. So I get this call of shame from the school nurse who told me I had to take him and get it examined. And now his sprained ankle is healed quickly with the helpful aid of a boot and a regimen of ice and ibuprofen. So can you even imagine if I was like, actually, you know what? No, thanks. He can keep limping. It's not that bad. I'll put him in some supportive shoes. Maybe I'll give him an ACE bandage. And no, he doesn't need a no for PE. He'll be just fine. Like, y'all know I'd be back on another call of shame with the school nurse, or maybe worse. I don't know. But here's the deal. We treat sprained ankles more seriously than the mental illnesses that literally kill off brain cells, because our culture only shames us for not treating one of those. I'm going to say that again.
Okay.
Nice. We treat sprained ankles more seriously than the mental illnesses that literally kill off brain cells, because our culture only shames us for not treating one of those. So I'm going to step off my soapbox now, but no, I'm preaching this to myself. I still absolutely struggle so much with this brand of mom guilt. Isabel, how about you? What's been a faithful step forward for you? What's something that you learned that has changed the way you approach your own mental health?
One thing that I have learned looking back, I realized, especially like in that first summer, there were times where I knew something was off and I could feel it different, and I just didn't want to confront it. So I purposely did not call my therapist. I did not tell you guys because I was scared of, like, I didn't want to go to the hospital. Mm. I didn't want to get sent away to a wilderness camp.
You were so worried about that. I remember you asked that so many times, like, are we going to send you to wilderness camp?
I blame TikTok. No, I was so scared. But like that specific brand of like avoidance was so negative for me. So looking back, I would definitely just be aware of when I'm feeling off or when I'm feeling sad. Like, even if it's normal, just like checking in with yourself and being like, hey, what's up? Like, what is causing this? Why are you feeling this way? And who can you go to talk about it?
Yeah.
Because there are people who are going to support you, even if you don't feel like it. Like, there is going to be someone there. And a lot of times those people have your best interests in heart and won't send you away to a wilderness camp.
I cannot even imagine. You bring up a really good point though, and I'd actually forgotten about this. You were in therapy. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't like you didn't have access to treatment and supports, whether those are family or friends or professional supports like therapists, like they can only help you with what you're willing to share with them. Yes. And I don't say that to be like, you should have done that differently, but in kind of this empowering way of like, you were carrying this really heavy burden. Mm-hmm. And when you're, you know, stuck in that kind of cycle where you have those ruminating thoughts and anxiety is feeding more anxiety, like things like wilderness camp feel very rational.
Yes.
And I would imagine that you've learned to kind of recognize thoughts that are, you know, spinning out of control.
Yeah.
And are irrational versus the ones that are like more grounded with reality, or that you can run them by people.
Yes.
Like, I'm worried about this. All right. Thanks for sharing. We'll let you share another one in a minute. But for me, a second faithful step forward is that I'm asking better questions and staying curious about the answers. So as parents, when our kids are little and they sneak into our rooms late at night after they've woken up from a nightmare, our response usually goes something like this. You're safe. It was just a dream. I love you. You know, maybe we send them back to bed. But can you even imagine, like, Isabel, this was you. You were the kid constantly coming to me with nightmares. Sure. Can you imagine if my response was like, Isabel, you dreamt the house was on fire. Oh my gosh, let's wake everybody up and get out now. Like, that would be really, that would be traumatizing. And we would never do that. Of course, it doesn't make any sense. But so much of parenting, especially when our kids are young, is calming their concerns. Not to minimize their feelings, but to tame the wildness of their imaginations. So we offer empathy for the feeling, and then we reframe the reality of the situation. So think of, like, if your child has a scraped knee or a stomach bug or even a fight with a friend, they likely see impending doom, but you know that they'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Isabel, when you were overwhelmed at the thought of going back to school, I remember those conversations. I hope I validated and empathized with your feelings, but then I reframed the reality. You were a strong student. You had lots of friends. Just slow down. Give yourself a chance to adjust before you make any decisions, which I think, like, by itself, it's not that it's bad advice. No, like, no. It all just seemed so rational, but not knowing the depth to which that overwhelm was gripping you, that reframe wasn't the best help. So now I'm leaning in. So Isabel, when you feel overwhelmed, I try now to really listen and to ask questions and to help both of us trust your discernment. Mm-hmm. So we're paying attention to the indicators. Is this anxiety over newness that will likely subside? You started a new job this year and you were really anxious about it. Mm-hmm. And again, like, we paid attention. We're like, okay, is this just newness or is it your body telling you that it's not really for you?
Yeah.
Things like, is there an undercurrent of overwhelm and what does that indicate? And, you know, if you need to say no to something, is that no going to be enough? Or is there something deeper that we need to get curious about and do some work around? Mm. And we're not, you had a dream, there's a fire, get out of the house, but it's recognizing your feelings again as indicators and asking questions to try to get to, you know, is this a passing thing? Is this an indicator of something more serious? And for my younger kids, I'm really kind of rolling it back and helping them learn to pay closer attention to what their bodies and feelings are telling them. Treating, again, those feelings as indicators to attune to instead of problems to fix. This does not mean their bodies and emotions run the show, but they do give valuable cues. So my 8-year-old daughter is really anxious in social situations, and she is learning how to use clearer language when anxiety shows up. When she's nervous about her school choir concert, we talk about where she feels it in her body. I know you love that question.
That is the worst question ever.
It's hard work though, isn't it? Ugh. But imagine if you had learned to do that at 8. Like, yeah, if that just felt normal.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I feel this. Where do I feel it? Mm-hmm. So I'm doing that with Josie. We talk about where she feels that in her body, what emotions it stirs up, what thoughts or stories go along with. Again, just bringing in some of those, like, spinny, spirally thoughts. Yeah. Like, what is your brain telling you about those feelings? So instead of just giving her tools to cope, we stay curious together. And it's not a 3-step plan. I wish I had a clear formula for how to do this. But zooming out, I'm just engaging in these curious conversations and helping my young kids learn to listen to their bodies instead of just neutralizing them. So we honor the stories their bodies tell first, and then we do work to cope with the messages that are firing on all cylinders through their brains and their nervous system. That is important too. Mm-hmm. It's slow work. It can be draining work. Isabel, you've watched us kind of walk through that process. You're like, just make them stop crying.
Oh, yes.
But if my 8-year-old, if your 8-year-old sister can discern the messages her body's telling her now, then imagine when she's 13 or 18, what kind of awareness that she'll have to distinguish between anxiety that will pass, anxiety she can cope with, anxiety that's demanding different interventions, or anxiety that's a red flag waving before a crash. Side note, this work is also helping me pay closer attention to the messages that my body's telling me as well. So like, this is going to sound like an infomercial, but it really had like, it's help. I've seen impact in like, it lessens my back pain. It's reduced migraines. It's increased my quality of sleep. It's wild. Like shutting yourself down, ignoring your feelings is not helpful.
Really?
Really. And it turns out we are in fact never too old to learn new things. So there you go. Isabel, how about you? What's another faithful step forward? What are you doing differently now that you didn't even know to do 3 years ago?
Yeah. I would say kind of going along with the last one, like the mindfulness aspect, I found journaling to be really helpful. Mm-hmm. And not in the, I'm going to use my little cute journal book where I fill in the prompts. No, I hate that. I would like to vent and tell everybody, or my journal at least, how much I hate my mom. Like, I want to be able to vent in that way. And I found that helpful because instead of bottling it up like inside, mm-hmm. or saying it to the person I'm mad at, I could go to my journal, write it down, and get it out of my system, out of my mind, and just calm down for a second, take a breather, and look back, read it back, and be like, oh my gosh, Isabel, you are so dramatic. Like, your feelings are valid, but what you said is not. Like, stuff like that. Reading it back. I also like to read it back and like see my growth. Like, yeah. I read back like what I said in like 2021, 2022. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Isabel, you were worried about that. It's totally fine. Like, you're all good now. And like, not everything's perfect, but I got into college. Like, and I was really worried about that. Yeah. And so like, seeing the progress has been really good for me, mm-hmm. especially like, cause I was stuck in that pit of like no progress, no, felt like no light at the end of the mm-hmm. tunnel. And now mm-hmm. like looking back, I'm in that light at the end of the tunnel. I can see the progress, and that's like really inspiring for me. And like, I just love journaling. And I also, another thing is I separate my journals. I have two journals. One is my angry journal, my angry journal and my scrapbook journal. So I write my angry words and I say my hateful things and then I scrapbook and I collect things over the week and I put it in there. And so I am writing, but also taking the time to be creative. So then there's the anger. There's the, let me settle down. Let me do something that I love. Then there's the read it back and process through and say, you're so dumb. And then I have my positive journal where I'm like, this is what I'm grateful for this week. This is what went really well. And I use that mostly on my Sabbath. Mm-hmm. I try to not use my negative journal from that Friday to Saturday. Cause I don't want to fill my whole week with anger. I do the scrapbook throughout the week cause I just love it. Mm-hmm. But my positive journal, I do keep separate cause I do like the idea of, separating the two things because I don't know. I feel like for manifestation, it works better.
And I hear a few different things. I mean, you started out by just saying like, oh, something that I do that's helpful is journaling, but there's a lot of ways to journal and not all of them are helpful for each person, you know, but what you're really narrating here is a whole process. Like the first step of that, like angry journal is taking those things that you would keep bottled up. Mm-hmm. And would you say like in putting those things on paper, like they lose some power?
Yeah, for sure. I think it does lose power because I'm not like harboring the anger against, like, I'm just using you as an example. Yeah, but
please do. Tell everybody how mad you are at me.
No, I'm not just like harboring that anger against you. And it could be things like you don't even know that you made me mad. But I'm so mad at you at that moment. So I just need to write it down. And then I'm like looking back because there are some things that I don't need to yell at you about. I don't need to point out because it's just you telling me to put my shoes away. I should just put my shoes away, guys. Like, but I'm going to write it down and say, I hate my mom because she's just telling me to do so many things. And then I look back and like, oh my God, so little.
Yeah. So it probably gives you a space again, like just, I've always said this about you. Like you are one of my kids. You're not the only one who just needs to like vomit feelings. Mm-hmm. Like they just sit and fester and make you ill sometimes literally. Yeah. And so getting them out and finding an appropriate way to get them out because it's totally fine that sometimes you feel like you hate me. That's totally fine. I empower you to feel that hatred. But what an appropriate way to get it out versus like I'm angry and I'm just gonna, whoever it is, I'm just gonna vent all over you. Like I have a space where I can vent it. And then it gives you the opportunity to sit back, read it back, mm-hmm. and find the truth and find the lie. Like, yeah. instead of, again, just ruminating on that thought, which when we do that, when we keep it bottled up, whatever it is, whether we're angry at somebody or we're nervous about a situation, keeping it bottled up makes it keep growing and gives mm-hmm. it like a really strong grip. So it gives you that chance. And then balancing it with, you know, those other processes of mm-hmm. scrapbooking and journaling, like the things that you're grateful for, walks you through a journey. And I love at the end how you talked about how reflecting back and seeing how far you've come gives you confidence moving forward. Yes. And when you first started journaling, like, you didn't have as much of that. Mm-hmm. But that's a really powerful tool of healing, of is being able to go, I was worried about this and it turned out okay, or it yeah. turned out great. So the next time you, and I've seen you apply that, like, you'll feel anxious about a new situation and you can kind of look around and look within and go, you know what? I've done harder things. Mm-hmm. I was scared then and it was okay.
Yeah.
I was scared then and I asked for help. I was scared then and whatever. So I can apply that moving forward. Mm-hmm. And that kind of journey of growth is really powerful, but it takes time. I'm really proud of you for the mm-hmm. way you've stuck with it. That's a hard, that's a hard process to stay with. So good for you. Well, before we close, I would love if each of us could share one truth we wish we could go back and tell ourselves in those early days. So a little bit of self-compassion. Isabel, let's start with you. If you could go back to that beginning point, if you could go back to summer of 2021, maybe even you can envision kind of a moment, what would you say to yourself?
That's hard. That's really hard. I think I would say, I'd say a couple things. Mm-hmm. I think I would start with, it is okay to tell somebody. Mm. What you're feeling, and that what you're feeling is not wrong. You're not less of a person. Mm-hmm. You're not less of a good student, less of a fun person. Like, you're not less than because you are feeling this way. And also that it is going to be scary to confront those, like, past situations or those emotions. It's going to be hard. It is not going to be fun at all times, but at the end of the tunnel, you're going to come out better and you are going to come out stronger and, like, more secure in yourself and who you are and your relationships with other people. So, like, it's going to be hard, but it's good. It's going to be good. And
I love that. This was hard for me to reflect on for myself. I think my first instinct is to go back and tell myself advice mm-hmm. and instead felt a prompt of, like, what did I need to hear in that moment? And so if I could go back and sort of meet myself on the couch in the therapist's office, or even more so, if I could come alongside myself in the moment after I left you in the hospital for the first time, which was probably the lowest moment of my life. That was rough. That was I'm sure sad. It was pretty low for you. I would say to myself, I would say this isn't your fault. And it's not Isabel's fault either. It just is. And you're going to help her through it simply by your unwavering commitment to walk with her every step of the day. And that will be enough. You sticking by her, rallying for her, fighting for her, loving for her. It will be so hard and so scary and so awful. I think I would want to tell myself the truth of that too. But also, I would want to say it will be enough. Even better, the God who works miracles will take this living sacrifice and multiply it. Or as Luke 6 says, you'll find life given back, but not merely given back. Given back with bonus and a blessing. Pressed down, shaken together to make room for more, running over and poured into your lap. This life on the other side of that dark tunnel feels like that. It feels like a bonus. It feels like a blessing, running over and poured into our lap. But first, we rode some waves.
Yes, we did.
And we nearly went under. Like, there were days where I was not sure we would survive.
Yeah.
So over the next couple of episodes, we're going to continue this conversation. And in the next episode, we're going to talk about riding the waves. So some practical things of what did work, what didn't work, how we navigated this as a team, the supports we leaned into, more or less of a survival guide, and our survival guide, not necessarily the one for you. Every situation is different. And then we're going to end with our final episode, which will be focused on the other side of the crisis. We're going to share some hopeful words, Which we got into a little bit today, as well as the truth of residual trauma and the ongoing work of supporting mental health, because you are in a different place. You are, I would say, on the other side of that dark tunnel, but it doesn't mean, like, you know, you kind of alluded to with journaling, it doesn't mean the work's done. It doesn't mean my work's done. Like, there's still things that we do and are mindful of. So. Thanks, Isabel, for joining us.
Of course.
This was a deep and difficult conversation, but we hung in it together, as we do.
Besties for the resties.
When you're not journaling about me.
Oh, yeah. Don't read my journal. We're besties until you read that journal. Then you might think differently.
Better out than in, honestly. Yeah, true. Let all the feelings out. That all right, is Isabel, true. Thanks for joining. Well, I don't know about you out there listening to the episode, but I've had some feelings here in this conversation. So let's close with a practice. For anyone who's traversed a dark season of the soul, we know that it can be hard to find the words to pray. What can we say to a God who feels far off? What words can convey the feelings we can barely tolerate, let alone describe? In these times, I've learned it's helpful to borrow the words of another and speak them back to God. During those unknown and terrifying days with Isabel, I was often drawn back to a psalm that I had felt God speak to me when she was still being formed in my own body. The words God spoke to me were a lifeline I clung to, and so I often spoke them back to God, a reminder to myself and perhaps a question to Him. Is this promise yes and amen, even here, even today? I would sometimes remove the I's and the my's and replace them with the name of my daughter, making the prayer more tangible, making it mine. Today, as I read this psalm, this prayer, offered up on the voices of great clouds of witnesses who came before me and that will be offered up on so many more beyond me, close your eyes, take a deep breath. Let this prayer become a promise you cling to, a question you carry, or a thin thread of hope to follow forward. Psalm 139, 1 to 18. You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise, you perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful to me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depth of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Thank you for joining me in today's episode of the Find Your Calm podcast. I hope you were able to connect with yourself to get your bearings, find your focus, and begin to enjoy or at least be more present to the life that's within and around you. Life is chaotic. We know this to be true. But even in the midst of chaos, you can find your calm and take your next faithful step forward. As always, you can connect with me on Instagram as Noelle C. Guevara. You can also head to my website, noellecguevara.com. You can sign up to follow along with me. I send out a monthly newsletter that typically dives in deeper to a topic that we're exploring on the podcast. So if you want to hear a little bit more of the in-between parts of this story, sign up for that on my website. Until next time, I'm Noelle C. Guevara, and I'm so grateful to be your host and guide as we navigate the chaos of life together.